Having married his own cousin, Darwin glumly suspected that certain physical and mental frailties among his children arose from a lack of diversity in his family tree. Darwin was often honored in his lifetime, but never for On the Origin of Species or Descent of Man. When the Royal Society bestowed on him the prestigious Copley Medal, it was for his geology, zoology, and botany, not evolutionary theories, and the Linnaean Society was similarly pleased to honor Darwin without embracing his radical notions. He was never knighted, though he was buried in Westminster Abbey next to Newton. He died at Down in April 1882. Mendel died 2 years later. Darwin's theory didn't really gain widespread acceptance until the 1930s and 1940s, with the advance of a refined theory called, with a certain hauteur, the modern synthesis, combining Darwin's ideas with those of Mendel and others. For Mendel, appreciation was also posthumous, though it came somewhat sooner. In 1900, three scientists working separately in Europe rediscovered Mendel's work more or less simultaneously. It was only because one of them, a Dutchman named Hugo de Vries, seemed set to claim Mendel's insights as his own, that a rival made it noisily clear that the credit really lay with the forgotten monk. The world was almost ready, but not quite, to begin to understand how we got here, how we made each other. It is fairly amazing to reflect that at the beginning of the 20th century, and for some years beyond, the best scientific minds in the world couldn't actually tell you where babies came from. And these, you may recall, were men who thought science was nearly at an end. 26. The Stuff of Life. If your two parents hadn't bonded just when they did, possibly to the second, possibly to the nanosecond, you wouldn't be here. And if their parents hadn't bonded in a precisely timely manner, you wouldn't be here either. And if their parents hadn't done likewise, and their parents before them, and so on, obviously and indefinitely, you wouldn't be here. Push backwards through time, and these ancestral debts begin to add up. Go back just 8 generations to about the time that Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln were born, and already there are over 250 people on whose timely couplings your existence depends. Continue further to the time of Shakespeare and the Mayflower Pilgrims, and you have no fewer than 16,384 ancestors earnestly exchanging genetic material in a way that would eventually and miraculously result in you. At 20 generations ago, the number of people procreating on your behalf has risen to 1,048,576. 5 generations before that, and there are no fewer than 33,554,432 men and women on whose devoted couplings your existence depends. By 30 generations ago, your total number of forebears, remember, these aren't cousins and aunts and other incidental relatives, but only parents and parents of parents in a line leading ineluctably to you, is over 1 billion. 1,073,741,824, to be precise. If you go back 64 generations to the time of the Romans, the number of people on whose cooperative efforts your eventual existence depends has risen to approximately 1 million trillion, which is several thousand times the total number of people who've ever lived. Clearly something's gone wrong with our math here. The answer, it may interest you to learn, is that your line is not pure. You couldn't be here without a little incest, actually quite a lot of incest, albeit at a genetically discrete remove. With so many millions of ancestors in your background, there will have been many occasions when a relative from your mother's side of the family procreated with some distant cousin from your father's side of the ledger. In fact, if you are in a partnership now with someone from your own race and country, the chances are excellent that you are at some level related. Indeed, if you look around you on a bus, or in a park, or cafe, or any crowded place, most of the people you see are very probably relatives. When someone boasts to you that he is descended from William the Conqueror or the Mayflower Pilgrims, you should answer at once, "Me too." In the most literal and fundamental sense, we are all family. We are also uncannily alike. Compare your genes with any other human beings, and on average, they will be about 99.9% the same. That is what makes us a species. The tiny differences in that remaining 0.1%, roughly one nucleotide base in every thousand, to quote the British geneticist and recent Nobel laureate John Sulston, are what endow us with our individuality. Much has been made in recent years of the unraveling of the human genome. In fact, there is no such thing as the human genome. Every human genome is different. Otherwise, we would all be identical. It is the endless recombinations of our genomes, each nearly identical but not quite, that make us what we are, both as individuals and as a species. But what exactly is this thing we call the genome? And what, come to that, are genes? Well, start with a cell again. Inside the cell is a nucleus, and inside each nucleus are the chromosomes, 46 little bundles of complexity, of which 23 come from your mother and 23 from your father. With a very few exceptions, every cell in your body, 99.999% of them, say, carries the same complement of chromosomes. The exceptions are red blood cells, some immune system cells, and egg and sperm cells, which for various organizational reasons don't carry the full genetic package. Chromosomes constitute the complete set of instructions necessary to make and maintain you, and are made of long strands of a little wonder chemical called deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. The most extraordinary molecule on Earth, as it has been called. DNA exists for just one reason, to create more DNA. And you have a lot of it inside you, about 6 feet of it squeezed into almost every cell. Each length of DNA comprises some 3.2 billion letters of coding, enough to provide 10 to the power of